With the summer sizzle starting to fizzle, cooler heads are looking to lock in a wellness routine fit for the fall and beyond. Lucky for you, Ritual's high standards don't drop with the temperature. Fully committed to traceable science and sourcing, Ritual is shaking up the supplement industry with high-quality ingredients and scientifically developed formulas. With them, you know what you're taking, where it comes from, and why it's important. They've got every base covered, from their clinically backed women's 18-plus multivitamin to groundbreaking options like stress relief and sleep melatonin, which both use first-of-its-kind BioSeries technology designed to optimize formula delivery. And right now, for a limited time, get up to 40% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast.
This is Joan.
Morning.
Joan is an owner-operator truck driver.
Yep, hauling some produce today.
She doesn't have the time to fool around.
Whew, so true.
Joan traded up to Geico Commercial Insurance for serious 360 coverage, not just for her truck, but for her cargo. She can even get serious savings for her inspection history.
So, where's the Geico twist? Is Napoleon going to come out driving a forklift?
Bonjour!
No, this is a serious Geico ad.
Oh, no. Au revoir!
Get more with Geico Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And hello, everyone. It is now December, and welcome to Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock, coming to you from a very, very snowy Toronto.
Yes.
Climate has Buffalo.
Same here.
Yes. Well, it is officially wintertime in our areas. Brandon, what are the vibes in Buffalo as the 10-2 Buffalo Bills eyeing supremacy? Is there a level of optimism, or is there a, oh God, what are we in for over these next, this playoff run for the Bills? Is there a bandwagon that is being jumped upon?
I don't really talk to people that much, but I think, I'm sure it's optimism. There was, as people saw on Sunday Night Football on NBC, there was a lot of snow if you were in Southern Erie County. We have counties here in the United States. And if you're in Southern Erie County, there's a lot of snow. I live north of Southern Erie County, let's say, and we did not have any snow until I woke up this morning, and there was substantial snow on the ground.
Yes, it was. We have been hit for the first time this year. I have to go pick up my kids from school later, and that will be a bit of an effort. But no one is tuning in for our thoughts on the weather, as I have learned over the years. But hey, we're going to share our thoughts nonetheless, as did Netflix, because on Tuesday they hosted select members of the media who got to come for a fireside chat, so to speak, with the likes of Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, Bella Bajaria, others in attendance as well, including Michael Cole hosting this whole get together. Select members of the media. Brandon, I guess the snow prevented you from venturing out of Buffalo to accept your invitation?
Yes. Well, this was in LA probably, right? Because it was at Netflix headquarters. I don't know that I would have gone to LA, but I would have considered it. How about you?
You know what? It was a game day decision for me. I was, I wanted to make the trip to, LA, but unfortunately here we are as analysts of the media discussion. And, this was quite the setup as they begin the big push for the launch on January the 6th. And the biggest headline coming out of this:
Becky Lynch is there. We have photographic evidence here.
Becky Lynch still with the company, still alive, as we see everyone here with their championship belt, some won in the ring, some handed over. I mean, Bella Bajaria crowned champion there. We have Nick Khan flanking everyone. I mean, look at this photo op. Bella Bajaria, of course, the creator of the
chief content officer of Netflix.
Chief content officer. Who had,
just as Paul Levesque is the chief content officer of WWE.
Yeah, we also, worthy name here to bring up, Brandon Reig, that apparently was the one that
individual right here.
First spoke to WWE years ago, telling them, get your international rights in order, line them all up, and then we can have a larger discussion. And that is what Nick Khan credits as the beginning of what would mature into this massive relationship with Netflix. So this was kind of the backdrop to, it sounded like this was a bit of a Q&A format, various reporting coming out of this from the Hollywood Reporter, Deadline, Variety, Sports Illustrated, and everyone rest assured, the PG era ain't going anywhere, okay? PG here to stay on Netflix.
This will be advertiser friendly. Don't worry. We're not going back to the Attitude Era.
Yes. I think that they, as much as there has been a clamoring for the return of John Wayne Bobbitt, potentially cutting off Val Venus's penis or blackface or any number of 1998 hits and misses, it looks as if Nick Khan stating, quote, we're not changing the rating of our programming. So there's some online chatter that it's going to be R-rated, or for us old folks, X-rated. That's definitely not happening. I was really hoping for porn on Monday nights. Unfortunately, Nick Khan throwing a wet blanket on that one. He stated, it's family-friendly, multi-generational, advertiser-friendly programming. It's going to stay that way. I would look for more global flair, especially as the relationship continues to develop. Countries outside of the U.S. are as important to us as the United States is. So we have certain targeted countries that are priorities for Netflix. They're priorities for us. You're going to see more of that. I think that's the way you'll see a bit of a difference. A global flair. A flair, yes, for the gold, if we could be so daring. And yes, the return of the WWE worldwide map, now no longer populated by NXT flags that they hope to plant, but instead Netflix territories. Are you a Netflix WWE home, or are you on the outside looking in come 2025?
Yes, I was able to put this map together for people watching in video because we need to get
the best graphics man in the game, by the way, Brandon Thurston.
But credit to WWE Network News, who actually someone from their site used a VPN and went to Netflix in all of these different countries. Wow. To figure out whether there's a placeholder on the interface for WWE. And this is what we've come up with here. So there's too much here to go through all 100 some odd countries, but you know, it's throughout South America.
You're telling me Russia is shut out of this revolution.
Russia has no Netflix whatsoever. You can't even watch Squid Game in Russia, at least not on Netflix. Same for China, North Korea, Syria, I think are the holdouts for, there's no Netflix in those countries.
Well, it is interesting that the focus on like the quote unquote PG era, and this whole time, like this company shifted to the official PG rating in 2008. And this became the source of so much fan frustration, is that this is what is handcuffing us. And I always found it to be somewhat of a kind of scapegoat excuse for a lot of the programming you were seeing, when fans never really lamented their childhood WWF when it was going through its popularity boom and was very much a PG-directed product. And today, you don't hear any of those complaints about what is quote-unquote under the PG umbrella with current programming. It's more so a case of there's good and there's bad, and the PG umbrella is a pretty wide net of, yes, you can do whatever you want. You are not at the mercy of like regulators of what you can get away with, but it is what you characterize your programming as. And there's quite a, I would say, a wider variety that we see today in WWE of what they can get away with. And even, you know, having Jada Parker yell out shit on NXT last night, like that's all stuff that falls under the window.
Whoever pushing for the return of the Attitude Era clearly does not have, and there's not that many of these people left, does not have a podcast looking back retrospectively at the Attitude Era to review it in 2024 to realize how bad some of that stuff was from the Attitude
Where's
Era.
Where's Midian? Why don't we have a version era of Midian today?
Why isn't there Katie Vick? Why isn't there more necrophilia in my wrestling? Why aren't there more individuals giving birth to hands? Why is that not in my professional wrestling today?
I mean, that's, you know, it's just back in my day, We could have a live birth on in Madison Square Garden. The other interesting note was, of course, the fallout from the Jake Paul Mike Tyson event. And Bella Bajaria was asked about the streaming issues. I don't think this was Michael Cole inquiring about these, but I will make that assumption. And Bella Bajaria, she of the Bad Man Gone soundbite earlier this year, noting, quote, "Whenever we do live events, we want it to go smoothly for every single one of our members. That's really important. Also, to put it in perspective, it was 65 million concurrent streams, right?" It was like she was asking this, right? I was like, I don't know. You didn't get Nielsen to audit these numbers, so we're taking your word for it. "It was a very successful night. A lot of people watched. The scale was very big, which is great. There's a lot of interest in it. We expected a big number for sure. It was a big number. But again, you don't know. And you can't learn these things until you do them, so you take a big swing. Our teams and our engineers are amazing. Moved super quickly and stabilized it. And many of the members had it back up and running pretty quickly. But we learned from those things. And we've all obviously done a lot of stuff to learn and get ready for the NFL and Beyonce at halftime. And so we're totally ready and excited for WWE."
Yeah. I had no issues watching the fight where I was, but I understand that was not the majority experience. They are having a company called VideoAmp, which we talked about before. They are having VideoAmp measure their viewership. Will we get actual ratings of Raw on Netflix? I don't know. But they are going to have someone doing third party measurement of their viewership, but apparently not Nielsen yet. Although Nielsen does at least measure how many people are watching a given streaming service or channel. So there is some sort of Nielsen measurement that's happening regardless.
And I think they are doing that for the NFL games on Christmas Day, if I'm not mistaken.
Nielsen is outright covering, is going to provide viewership data for the NFL game. I don't expect there to be huge issues with WWE because it's going to be such a smaller audience. They will have another test here with the NFL game, but it's going to be globally, I don't know. It'll be a few million people maybe watching live.
One question here. Do we have an update on the January 3rd SmackDown in Canada and other international markets? I have not gotten an answer about this when I inquired. So for those that don't, are familiar with at least the Canadian, and I imagine this goes for other international markets. Originally, if you went onto your Netflix app, if you were in Canada, the first date listed was the January 3rd SmackDown to coincide with this new deal. Now that's been pushed to January 6th being the launch of any WWE programming on Netflix. Sportsnet's deal, and I did confirm this, it ends December 31st. And so this January 3rd SmackDown, it's still a question of where and how this is going to be accessible, because it sounds like Netflix will not be airing this January 3rd SmackDown, but that is still to be determined, I guess.
Will it be airing on NordVPN?
Well, I guess if you want to go and seek out the USA Network in your country of choice, that might be your backup option. Everyone needs to be up to date with their VPNs when it comes to being a pro wrestling connoisseur.
While we're at it here, I've been alerted that Raw episodes, so the archive of the past Raw episodes, have a display tag on them saying that they're going to expire as of a few days ago, within 30 days. So I'm talking about Peacock here in the United States, those episodes are going away from Peacock. So I have to think that means that the archive, or at least the next day, well, the archive is maybe part of the Netflix deal. So I don't know if those episodes are going to be available in the United States on Netflix. I imagine maybe they don't know yet. And so there isn't clear messaging or clear marketing about whether it's in the United States or globally, how much of not just past episodes of weekly television will be available, but what's most important is those world-class episodes, those Mid-South episodes, the few Smoky Mountain episodes that they have. Are those going to be on Netflix? I don't know.
Let's just say that if the WWE Network for these international markets is not reflected on the new Netflix, this is going to be the worst January 6th among a tribalistic fan base that you are ever going to observe.
I was thinking, because I know you guys talked about this on Ask Away, that, they do have this new WWE Vault YouTube channel. And I almost wonder if that is a better way to monetize the old territory stuff, at least, stuff that's not within the last few years, even. especially stuff that's not originally under the WWE brand, in that, like, how many more subscriptions are you really driving for your partner versus, well, if you just put something up on YouTube and it gets a few hundred thousand views or something like that, that might be now we're talking about a small amount of revenue difference there, but that might be a better way to monetize that content versus selling it to your streaming provider, licensing it.
It also promotes like a recurring, consumer to go back to that channel every day. You're putting something up that's a lot more digestible than, say, a season of Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Yeah, we want it all up at all at once, though.
I think people like the idea that it's there, that it's accessible, but how many people have gone back to watch 1993 Smoky Mountain Wrestling? Like, I would imagine today, it's very realistic. Some of these episodes are getting like under 10 views in a given week, and that might be charitable.
Yeah, I think at this point, the value of a big video library is pretty small. I think there were those years after 2014 in WWE's case of its library where that stuff was, and they have the data to know, where I imagine that that stuff was consumed at a much higher rate at that time than it has been in the last few years. That's sort of people have had that opportunity to binge on the smorgasbord of WWE's library. And that time is gone now.
Well, if they're, is one person or a team that is curating this WWE Vault channel, that's on my wish list for a guest in 2025. This is the person I want to uncover and have on the show.
Is that who we should request? Yes.
Yeah. Who's digging up CM Punk and Amazing Red from 2005 dark matches? I mean, it is, I mean, they have endless supply. That I think that channel really is a very effective tool for, utilizing its archive on the WWE Network front. When it comes to the U.S. rights, which of course come up in early 2026, Nick Khan was asked about this and stated Peacock is our incumbent partner and we're always going to respect our incumbent's rights in the relationship we have there. So we'll have those conversations with them in 2025 and we'll see what shakes up. We will see what shakes up. Nick Khan also got in a bit of a dig on Paramount. Did you hear about this?
I think that was Paul Levesque, who said that Paramount is basically irrelevant now.
Wholly irrelevant.
I think that was a Paul Levesque quote. Paul Levesque once again revealing that he's not watching the latest hot TV programs in media today. Apparently not a Yellowstone viewer, which is one of the most watched scripted shows on any platform, including live TV. But there's some truth to that in that, you know, there's not that much else on, especially on a Paramount's cable networks at this point.
And of course, you know, this is going to overlap where WWE is shopping their streaming rights for the network. At around the same time, UFC is going to be negotiating its big package. And you have to imagine with both negotiations that Netflix is going to be, I would say, in the mix for at the very least. And we will see what shakes up.
They'll have at least a few months at that point to see how whatever downstream benefits they have of being on Netflix, whatever tech issues or not there are in broadcasting live on Netflix there are. So they'll be well informed to know whether or not Netflix is a really valuable place for them. And if they want to make a deal for the Peacock content, I guess I would lean towards maybe they do go with Netflix and move away a little bit from NBC Universal.
Jake from the Windy City, just stating that the UFC has Fight Pass. WWE can make it in-house, referring to, I guess it's network. I mean, it could, like there is, it's a small number, but I mean,
and maybe that's an even better way to monetize it is have people pay directly for that library access in a in-house, as Jake here says, in-house subscription service like Fight Pass. That's the only way you can watch Pride now, right?
Legally. That's it. You have to have Fight Pass. So
definitely only legally. Because we don't want to get sued by UFC's very busy lawyers who are going after people for piracy.
That's it. Don't mess with our IP. Another interesting note that was brought up here by Paul Levesque. He was asked about sort of, I guess, different changes to their formats and such. And he was talking about the creation of new stars. And he said, as we create more and more stars, it sort of creates this opportunity for stars to be able to come in and come out because you're not reliant on the same people every week to get you to where you need to get to. And he cited Drew McIntyre returning on Monday, stating Drew was dying to come back. He wasn't hurt. He wasn't injured. We just thought, let's give him a little breather for a second. And whether that's spending time at home, enjoying your family, whatever that is, whether it's you have another project you want to work on, I have this project that Netflix has come up with, I'm going to work on that. Us having the ability to morph and shift things around and keep things fresh, I think, is a tremendous opportunity for us. So I'd like for more of that as well. It's an interesting look at where you have seen, like, just looking up today, some of the, like, just match totals for this year. Like, as you can imagine, with a few exceptions, like, everyone's match totals are down this year. And the leader is Cody. He had 93 matches this year. Maybe he hits 100 with the live events at the end of the month. But overall, we're talking about, and that's your most active performer. And I think for the creative side of things, like, there is a value to, you can swap guys in and out. It allows for a refresh of your stories. You're not riding with a pat hand. And there's also, this is at a time when between WWE and AEW, like, we are seeing way less in ring for these performers, and there's probably merits to that, and there's a downside to it as well, but it's definitely a trend that both companies have seemed to embrace pretty wholeheartedly, AEW from the onset and WWE in this era of really limiting its live event schedule.
Yeah, and so what I'm showing on the screen here is, as of last year in 2023, they ran about 219 events, and so it's I imagine it's going to be a little lower for this year when the total comes in. I'm sure they're on track for lower. So it's not a relatively new thing, especially after the pandemic. They never got back to 300 events as they were at, you know, throughout almost their entire history prior. And we have, when I've dug into the archives, I was able to find 848 events insane. In 1987, when they were running, you know, three shows simultaneously or something like that. But then that piece is reflective.
Fueled by cocaine as well. Yes. I mean, how these people got through these, like, you know, the nights when they were literally running 3 to 4 crews a night and had none of, like, at least in the last decade or so, like, you had tour schedules that made sense. I mean, in the 80s, you can look at it, these guys are crisscrossing the country in multiple time zones. Like, it's a miracle some of these people even came out of that era.
And no joke, many of them didn't. I mean, go back and look at the cards of some of these house shows from the 80s, and a lot of these people are not alive anymore. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's reflective of this business being a live event business, especially in the 80s and into the 90s. And it's become less and less of a live event business as TV rights deals have gotten better and better. And you need to rely on live events less and less. And the live event becomes more about the media production and less about just doing the event. So it just becomes, you know, wiser to do fewer events. And Mark Shapiro has really been pushing the idea that they don't need to do as many of these house shows in smaller markets because the profit margin isn't really there. So I think, you know, sort of what the quote from Paul Levesque is getting at there is that I think it becomes more of like a voluntary territory system or a rotation system that I think is really important. I think we've seen bear it out throughout even recent years in terms of, I mean, look at how hot Brock Lesnar was in the period where he would only show up once in a while. Roman Reigns, I think, has become a bigger star because he's seen less often. There's scarcity in having him there.
Six matches this year. He's done.
And I would even go so far as to say, even look at Hulk Hogan, even in the prime of his career. It's not like he was wrestling on TV all the time.
You never got to see him on TV unless for the odd Saturday night's main event. But you had to pay either for a ticket or a pay-per-view to see a Hulk Hogan.
It's only in this post-Monday Night War era where it's become the regular thing and just assumed it's going to happen thing of having stars wrestle on TV every week or every other week. That just didn't happen in any other era before then. And we're seeing sort of a remedy or sort of a situation that's getting it back to that, I guess.
And I would say for the WWE product, and this is definitely amplified for a while for me watching it, but it really came into focus like these last couple of weeks, is as like you're still getting like it's fairly like name versus name matches on all of your programming. It would be very hard to go back to a format of like your enhancement talent, but it does still feel like you're getting the big match at the pay-per-view. That's where you will get your quote unquote, like bell to bell content from a WWE perspective. But at the same time, for a lot of fans that are tuning in, like the big attraction of TV is not so much the big match. It's the big star segment and getting.
Because you seldom know what you're even going to see in advance, except for maybe the week before.
No, but I would argue that today it's like, even if you promoted, like a big match a week in advance, it's like, what are we seeing that really means? It's like a big bloodline segment. It's Roman Reigns and CM Punk are going to sit down at a table on SmackDown or open with a 25-minute talking segment at the beginning, and the live audience is buzzing about it. Like, it's stars in big segments having compelling story-driven segments, as opposed to like just the wrestling match that it is built around. And for a longevity standpoint, like, there's great positives. If you can put two stars out on television to talk for 20 minutes, and we don't have the raw numbers, I'm sure that commercial-free 25 minutes did an incredible audience on Monday. So, like, that bears it
should
out.
Should have it later. Yeah. I think it's what makes it hard to compare and interpret today's wrestling business through the same templates of analyzing them that we always have, as far as like, well, who's drawing money? What main event is drawing money? That's what we try to look back into the 80s and 90s to see, like, well, this house show program really outdrew the other house show programs. It's really hard to make that comparison today, especially as live events become less important. And as you're saying, it's not even necessarily about the matches, right? Of course, it's about just, well, we were there to see the show, or we're there to see this compelling product that's got this really interesting bloodline thing. And I like the crowd interaction, and I like yelling yeet, and acknowledge him, or whatever people are doing as I walk through the concourse and observe them doing. And it's less about the old way of interpreting and evaluating the business.
Miles here is an electrician running wiring for this new home build.
Good morning.
Miles doesn't have time for funny business.
I guess.
Miles traded up to Sirius Commercial Auto Insurance from GEICO for customized coverage that grows with his business, all for seriously low rates.
So where's the GEICO surprise cameo?
Come again?
You know, like some big famous football player or something. He's going to bust through that wall, isn't he?
No, this ad is serious business.
Guys, get over here. You got to see this.
No, there's nothing funny over here. Sorry.
Get more with GEICO Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.
Coming up December on the Post Wrestling Cafe, two editions of Rewind Away coming your way, including Dave Bautista starting in the M. Night Shyamalan horror film Knock at the Cabin. Plus, we will review Noah's Departure card from 2004 featuring Kenta Kobashi and Jun Akiyama. Plus, reviews of ROH Final Battle, Strong Style Evolved, and the granddaddy of them all, the best and worst of show for 2024 with Brayden Harrington, Davey Portman, Wei Ting, and yours truly. PostWrestlingCafe.com. So if you have any questions regarding Netflix or anything, actually, we will be monitoring the comment section if you want to get any questions in. But Brandon, you did some reporting on Tuesday when it comes to the Ring Boy lawsuit and a response from WWE as it relates to the law that was passed in Maryland. And maybe you just want to explain why this suit was filed in Maryland, in that jurisdiction that makes that pretty central to this Ring Boy lawsuit.
Right, because there is a new law in Maryland. This is at the state level, but there's a new law called the Child Victims Act, which basically, on its face, and I was up late last night listening to the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court, more on that later. This is a new law that was signed into law by the governor in April 2023, and it removes the statute of limitations, not only so that you can sue and pursue justice against people who are alleged to have actually done child abuse or child sexual abuse, but you can also sue. It removes the time limit on when you can sue somebody who you allege is negligent of child sexual abuse, which is exactly what the Ring Boys are alleging here. They're alleging that WWE itself, and by virtue of that, their parent company TKO, who inherited all their liabilities by virtue of that merger, as well as the lead executives at the time, are named defendants, Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon. They are alleged to have been negligent to have allowed these five anonymous Ring Boys to be sexually abused, allegedly, by former ring announcer Mel Phillips. So this act comes into play, and it makes it possible to file this lawsuit in the state of Maryland. And they do allege that at least some of this abuse happened in the state of Maryland. WWE was running in Baltimore at the time, so you can see how that lines up. So there are, as you can imagine, this law gets signed into law, and you have a number of lawsuits against things like schools and churches that are, where people are now adults, claiming that they were sexually abused by people who had, power over them or supervision over them. And WWE, now, not only did they move the lawsuit out of, they've moved the lawsuit out of state court where it was originally filed, and they have filed to put it in federal court. So the federal judge will have to make a decision about that, as well as what WWE is pushing for here, which is there's a Supreme Court case, not U.S. Supreme Court, but Maryland Supreme Court case that's looking into whether or not this law can be enforced. I listened to the oral arguments last night, some of them, and there appears to be some, there's some litigation here about whether or not this 2017 law that came before it actually sort of irrevocably gives these people immunity after a certain time limit was my understanding. But WWE wants this Supreme Court case to be ruled on before this lawsuit can go forward. So they're asking the judge to put a stay on this. And when we're familiar with stays here in the world of wrestling legal talk, because we know that the Janelle Grant case is on a stay until only some 7 days from now. So they are moving to have that lawsuit put on hold, put on pause until the state Supreme Court makes a decision about how this law is going to be interpreted. They're due to make a decision by sometime before August 31st, 2025, because that's when their session ends. So sometime before then, they should have a ruling on this.
Yes. And if that were to be struck down, that would essentially eliminate the ability for this lawsuit to move forward, correct?
Yes, you would think so. It seems pretty likely that the judge would approve of this, because there are a number of other cases in the state of Maryland that have been put on hold pending a decision from the Supreme Court. But yeah, if the Supreme Court of Maryland decides that no, this actually doesn't give you the ability to rightly sue somebody for negligence past 20 years or something like that, then you would think that this case gets easily dismissed.
And as we've continued to talk about, I mean, this Ring Boy lawsuit, it has received a lot more of attention because of Linda McMahon's, potential appointment to become the head of education under the Trump administration, where this has been, you know, brought up pretty prominently as like a big mark against Linda McMahon. But from the sense of things, not enough that this is going to be disqualifying for Linda McMahon, but it certainly has gained a lot of coverage and part of Linda McMahon's, the negatives against this appointment.
Yeah, I mean, so she's nominated to be the Secretary of Education. And you know, there was an article that was originally published with the 19th, which I understand is maybe that's a publication that's based on the 19th Amendment, but looking at women's rights and looking at Title IX. It was an article that you shared with me today that was syndicated through the Connecticut Mirror. Connecticut, of course, is where Linda McMahon lives and has had apparently she has a residence in Florida as well, but obviously she ran for Senate there, and that's where WWE is headquartered. But that article is raising all these issues about, like, how can you trust this person to be the Secretary of Education to oversee schools when this person is allegedly negligent for child sexual abuse, in the 80s.
Yeah. One of the comments in here was from Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, which is a labor union that represents almost 2 million members. Quote, the sexual misconduct lawsuit, it's going to get a lot of scrutiny, and I'm very troubled by those allegations. She, referring to Linda McMahon, is going to have to respond to them about whether or not she was complicit in hiding or in covering up sexual assault. How can you be the head of education in America? It's antithetical, right? I don't know if she's just asking right as if anyone's going to respond. I would argue that in 2024, 2025, you can move forward with a very prominent position overseeing education in America with this, with such a lawsuit hanging over you.
And as this article points out, I mean, Donald Trump himself has been found liable for sexual assault in the case of E. Jean Carroll. And that didn't prevent the majority of voters, or, you know, the plurality of voters from voting for him for president.
So there you have it on that particular case. We shall move on. And WWE Survivor Series was held this past weekend at Rogers Arena in Vancouver, British Columbia, as WWE returned to Canada. And man, we got a announcement on the broadcast that they had set an arena record in Canada, a record that they were able to break by the time the press conference took place, because Paul Levesque gave us the updated stat of what they had achieved.
Canada always delivers, Vancouver no different. as was just mentioned, been a long time since we've been here in Vancouver. Something that we wanted to fix and come here with a big event. And they certainly delivered tonight. We set, an all time North American arena gate record here tonight. So, Quaker, that's our, it was sold out, 17,828 in the building tonight. And, that is our 63rd sellout for the year. So we've had quite a year, and it's wonderful to be able to cap it off here in Vancouver.
North American arena record set with the Survivor Series. Not giving out a gate figure, but obviously a very healthy number that they drew, and breaking what was a Canadian record just 2 hours before. So congratulations to WWE. Maybe inflation kicked in between the event and the post show.
Yeah, I know Paul Vec had some trouble with the was the Berlin gate. In any case, so higher than any arena gate that they've ever done. They also set in Philadelphia for the the post Raw or the pre SmackDown of WrestleMania that was the arena gate domestically at the time. I would think this if they're saying North America, that includes domestically the United States. I would think this is well over 2 million. We've seen when we occasionally get Polestar numbers just of TV tapings. You know, $1 million gate is just normal for them for Raw or SmackDown. So I imagine this is well over 2 million. The international record is something well over 3 million at this point, because we know that Money in the Bank in London did well over 3 million equivalent in US dollars. So it's reflective of what we hear all the time. Oh my God, these ticket prices are so high, and they're getting more money per head than ever here, I think, for WWE events. And we're seeing their attendance start to level off. Their attendance comparisons are getting a little bit negative, as opposed to just skyrocketing as they have for the last couple of years. But I imagine that the revenue has not leveled off. If anything, the revenue is increasing for ticket sales, because the ticket prices are so much higher.
Yeah, and they're about to put tickets on sale for the Elimination Chamber show in Toronto, which will be at Rogers Center, which, I mean, from all indications, that should shatter their at least Canadian record. I'm sure that event is going to top their prior WrestleManias in the same stadium.
Yeah, especially with the inflation. We're talking about 2002 and 1990, the two WrestleManias in Toronto.
Let's chat a bit about WWE's next endeavor. They are coming back to NBC a week from Saturday. It is the relaunch. It's the latest rebirth of Saturday night's main event as this part of the big deal of SmackDown going back to the USA Network. And this would include 4 specials per year. And just this morning, they have already confirmed an earlier report from the Wrestling Observer that the second Saturday night's main event will be January 25th, which is the week before Royal Rumble. That event will be staged in San Antonio, Texas. But the I thought it'd be interesting to look at what they are up against next Saturday night, because if you recall, the I guess we can call it second iteration of Saturday night's main event from 2006 to 2008 was not deemed a viable ratings winner for NBC. It lasted they did 2 specials per year in 06, 07, and then did one more in 2008 before that NBC slot was occupied by things like Tribute to the Troops and other programming to fulfill that portion of the contract. But they got away from Saturday night's main event. This time around, I mean, they're going to be up against, on that night, besides Collision on TNT, which is probably going to get demolished, college basketball will air on NBC. There will be an NBA game on ABC. ESPN will have the Heisman Trophy ceremony, and then ESPN2 will have women's volleyball followed by the UFC prelims for a fight night event. But the big one they're going up against, CBS, the holiday film Nugget Is Dead will be airing as well. Suffice to say, I think WWE will perform well on against this particular competition against, they've got an NBA game, college basketball. Those would be the 2 key ones. I don't know what the Heisman Trophy ceremony will do. That's out of my purview.
Did you say there's something on NBC? It's airing on NBC, right?
Sorry. College basketball is airing on Fox, I believe. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and this is also going to simulcast on Peacock, right?
Correct.
So I wonder if we're going to get a total audience delivery number from NBC PR. I imagine it'll do pretty well. It's going to be, I suppose, cannibalized. This will be the first time, right, that we've had like a major streaming simulcast for a WWE event, which will be the norm for AEW in the new year. But I'm curious to see, because we're going to look at it and say, okay, but there were some percentage of viewers here who were watching on Peacock, not just on NBC here. Do you think this does, I guess we'll definitely get a traditional number. Does this do what a Raw does on NBC or a SmackDown? Because this is not a normal time slot. This is not a habitual time slot for wrestling viewing. This Saturday, at least for WWE, for, you know, Saturday night on it is on broadcast though. And we saw what, you know, there was elevated viewership for SmackDown just by virtue of being on Fox, and they immediately moved over to USA. And we've seen a significant drop off in viewership because of that.
Before I answer your question, for comparison's sake, their return in March 2006. So again, we're going back 18 years here. And this was deemed, not successful.
Good. Yeah. Yeah.
5.15 million viewers, which was a combination of live and same day video and TiVo watching, according to the Observer. And it was, out of 82 primetime shows that week on the networks, it ranked 80th. And then by the last show in August 08, they were down to 2.26 million viewers. And that was the last one. I think that this should outdo, a SmackDown number if we're talking like 1.3, 1.4. But I mean, Raw's not doing that appreciably higher than that. I mean, this week Raw was just over 1.5 million viewers. I think this tops it. I think this tops a Raw or a SmackDown. I don't know if it hits 2 million for the 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. I'm scrambling to look at, to see in 2006, March 18th. We have 4.85 million viewers was what must be live same day. And then in the second hour, they did 5.6 million viewers. Again, that's 2006. The next one did 3.6 million. And then in the second hour did 4.7 million. So huge difference.
God, these are huge jumps in that second hour. That's crazy. Yeah. It sounds like the show started at the wrong time.
I'll show you what I'm looking at here. It's a giant Google sheet with like every wrestling rating ever. And then down to in June 2007. So this is just before Benoit happens, right? 2.7 million.
Benoit was on this show, everyone. Trivia note, Chris Benoit on NBC television weeks before the murder-suicide.
A median age of 38. Wouldn't you love that? A demo rating of 1.25. And I'm sure this was a disappointing number. But just get, you know, keep in mind that viewership has declined generally, right? And here we have August 2007, 6 million viewers, a 1.38 demo rating. And that is the same sort of demo rating that we talk about today. That's what I put in the spreadsheet. Well, I'm sure they would love those numbers today, but you know, the bar of success will be lower, I think.
Well, that's the combination of factors. I mean, the bar for success on broadcast is significantly lower that I think WWE is going to perform very well here. I do not know if they can necessarily win the night given the sports competition they are against, but I think that you will get a very strong performance out of them. I mean, we pretty much have the lineup at this point. It's, you know, it's anchored by the Cody Rhodes, Kevin Owens match that has been built up pretty strong. So you are putting your biggest star here. And one would think they put some kind of bloodline segment onto this, and that would get some Roman Reigns involvement. I'm more curious for the January 25th show, because that's effectively your go home show before the Royal Rumble to do whatever last minute angles or stuff to build up. And I look at that as a positive to have that kind of exposure your week before the Rumble. Potentially in front of a larger audience than your Monday or Friday night.
Can you recall what, In these 2006, 2008 Saturday Night Main Event, can you recall any matches or anything big that happened on these shows? Like, what I'm getting at is, was there a real effort put into those episodes?
I mean, only because I went through it this morning. Like, the first one, they did build up pretty big. They had Austin do a segment on this. Remember, this is like years after his retirement, but they're still utilizing him. They had Hulk Hogan on that first episode. But yeah, I mean, in terms of, they did one big title change at the end, because one of them happened right after the whole RVD Sabu arrest. So they got the belt off of RVD on one of these shows. But I mean, at the time, the big criticism was just that you know, your audience is getting this kind of programming on Raw, on SmackDown, that the novelty, that really drew people to the initial Saturday night's main events. It's not there because you're getting this with so many hours per week. And WWE was at a much lower profile. I would say 06 to 08. This is not a big boom period for the company. And you can see that with that first show, relying a heavy amount on nostalgia, which I'm sure this one will too. When you are looking at the way they're promoting this event and you have, you know, Jesse Ventura rumored for this show and Jimmy Hart rumored for this show. It's a combination of our new stars, but also a healthy amount of nostalgia that I'm sure you'll see attached to this return.
You have Edge versus Jeff Hardy was the main event of the last telecast. And I'm looking at 1992. So yeah, anyway, I imagine, you know, you've got a head of creative who's not Vince McMahon. So there's some hope that there will actually be something that people want to see more so than they did in 2008 or so.
Yeah. Probably no reunion of Jesse and Vince on Saturday.
Yeah. Well, there'd be a wedding. Was one of the like Uncle Elmer weddings. Was that on a Saturday night's main event? If you really wanted to juice the ratings, just do a wedding.
I think that was Tuesday Night Titans. But I mean, you can't just throw things out like that on NBC without, you know, the proper, maybe we'll get a wedding for January 25th. Maybe, we'll have some time until we get to, January, but, it will be a very, important number to look at. And, you know, getting these four quarterly specials, for WWE, you know, they may be as much of an enhancement to NBC as the other way around, because it's, you know, it's WWE's at that stage right now where they
What I should look at is what does NBC usually do in primetime on a Saturday night, and what does this deliver? Does it do better than what the replacement programming would be is basically always the answer to how successful does this need to be. And it'll be muddied by the Peacock simulcast, though.
Also, in going through several numbers this week, I did find this interesting, is that we have now got basically 2 months of NXT on CW. And what has the move to from USA to CW, what exactly has that meant for NXT? And they moved there October 1st. And of course, the first 2 weeks were heightened by the premiere that included CM Punk, and week two that had Randy Orton. So you saw in September, they went from 639,000 viewers on USA. That jumps to 740 in October. And in November, they have come right down exactly to 639,000 viewers that they were on USA in September, slightly below in 18 to 49, going down from 256,000 to 224,000 from September to November. So, I mean, granted, it's been 2 months, but it has not been, I mean, granted, CW is kind of, it is by technicality a broadcast network, not a highly rated one. And this is still very good numbers by the standards of CW, but for NXT growing its audience, it's kind of been a push now that we've seen what it's normalized at without your even including like hotshotting like an ECW themed event. But it's kind of like it's taken its audience. It hasn't grown. It hasn't shrunk. But the CW move has not provided a, you know, a new audience. It doesn't appear.
I guess what it really tells me, and this is, you know, sort of what we tentatively expected. This is going from a really strong cable network in USA to a pretty mild broadcast network in CW. So broadcast means more homes, but lower profile means what some amorphous lack of marketing power or lack of power that results in viewership. So we expected it to be a push, that it would be about the same viewership, but not really sure how it would turn out. And it has been about the same viewership. And I would contrast that against what SmackDown has done. And I think I've got charts in here for SmackDown as well. But where SmackDown really has been hurt by the, in terms of viewership, again, not unexpected, but really has lost viewership by moving away from Fox to the USA Network. And I think, you know, if NXT was on Fox, it would be in a similar number of homes as CW, but it would probably be doing a lot stronger viewership, just because it really is some difference in value of the stronger network here, even when it comes to wrestling fans and how, you know, habitual wrestling fans are of, you know, watching wrestling on whatever network. It really does matter what network you are on too.
Would you, if we're looking at where USA Network is going to be in 5 years versus NXT being on broadcast, even when the level of CW, is there a certain comfort you have with broadcast that a lot of these entities seem to have versus cable that, I mean, USA is going to be part of this spun off company. And I mean, the future of a USA network seems to be one where you can't predict where this is going to be in 5 years. Is there more of a stability of just being on broadcast, even at a lower end one like CW?
I think they view it. And this is how, you know, I think AEW is viewing it in terms of the rumors that we hear about AEW trying to get on a broadcast network with some new program, is that it's just more homes, right? Like this is why it's really important to be on streaming, because you're in homes that only have streaming. Don't ever subscribe to cable and don't put an antenna on their wall so they can watch CW or Fox. But then you have the people who, you know, only watch television, primarily watch television through traditional means, through cable or satellite. And then you have people who don't have cable, maybe who aren't subscribing to Netflix or Peacock, but they do have the ability to watch stuff on broadcast. And it's just maximizing the number of homes that you're in. And there are three lanes that you have to cover, and that is cable, streaming, and broadcast. And I think that's maybe among other reasons why it made sense for NXT to go to CW.
And it does feel like this philosophy of WWE of kind of just casting multiple lines into the water, that they have their foot in streaming with the biggest streamer you could have. We're in cable, we're on broadcast, and it seems as though we're just going to spread our chips across the board and just try to have as much accessibility as possible in all these different areas.
Yeah.
Moving on to AEW. Yay or nay on our next clip, Brandon?
Oh, you're asking me to prove right now? Go ahead. Do what you want.
About your take on the current state of All Elite Wrestling. What do you think? How are they doing right now?
Yeah, well, they're horrible. Come on. It's just, I've given up. You know, I used to get really frustrated with them because I actually hate seeing people screw up good opportunities. I know what that feels like. And I know how hard good opportunities are to come by. So when you see somebody just shooting themselves in the foot day after day, week after week, in every possible way, it's frustrating for me. And I would vent that frustration. Now it's just like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, it's just, it is what it is. There's no hope for them. Nothing's going to turn that company around. There's no light bulb going to go off in anybody's head and all of a sudden realize, oh, this is how we actually get people to watch TV. They have no idea what they're doing, and they're too stubborn to learn. There's the stories, if there are any, are so bad that only the lowest form of wrestling intellect on the planet finds enjoyment in it. Now, you will find some people, and I think this is cool. If you just like the physical presentation, guys flying all over the place and doing all kinds of athletically amazing stuff, and you don't care about story, you don't care about characters, that's your jam. AEW is your jam. And if that's what you like, more power to you, man. I'm glad you found it. It's just not viable for the masses. Tony's vision for that company, I guess, is to provide content for that percentage of the audience that only cares about high risk, high altitude, fast paced action, and not about story and not about characters.
That was Eric Bischoff appearing on the Ariel Helwani show earlier this week, just before his appearance on
NXT's Eric Bischoff.
NXT's Eric Bischoff, MLW's Eric Bischoff, as he is doing their one shot show this week. But a lot there from Eric Bischoff. And
do you agree with his characterization of AEW content, first off?
In terms of what the his assessment.
There's no story. It's just people flying around and doing moves and
that. No, I think that's an overly simplistic summary. That's a very easy argument to make about AEW, but really does not hold up to scrutiny. Now, where I will concede is that you can have your opinions on the effectiveness of AEW's stories, but to say they are divorced from storytelling, I just don't think would be accurate. You can watch AEW. There's plenty of stories going on. Some work, some don't. There's a ton that goes on these shows. I would hardly call this a cohesive show when it comes to its storytelling, but it exists. And for better or worse, I think the loudest critics of AEW have been able to brand a product that enhances its in-ring as a negative, that going out and trying to have great matches is a negative, that it's lazy or that it's somehow, it's not real wrestling. That's fine if you want to characterize that, but I think that's too simplistic of a view for AEW. And I think it becomes very difficult when people try to have honest discussions about AEW, because to paint everything as rosy and positive and just lean on this new television deal they have signed, I think you are burying your head in the sand to a lot of empirical evidence, many of which comes from Brandon Thurston, that you can observe very objectively and see where things are. From, we're not going back to 2019. We're looking at 6 months ago. We're looking from 12 months ago. Where things have gone, where its popularity is, and you can address those issues, and everyone can come up with their theories on what they would change, what would be different. But there's absolutely problems that are there that you could ignore or you can address. But it just becomes such a volatile issue, and especially when it comes from an Eric Bischoff, it's going to be met with detractors and those that completely kneel at the thoughts that are espoused by an Eric Bischoff, and you get a totally muddled view of where things are.
Yeah, I disagree with Eric's diagnosis of what the issue is. The issue is not the lack of story. Maybe it's a lack of good story or good compelling TV, whatever that is. It's not. I don't view AEW content as he does. And I agree with what you just said, which we discussed a bit off air, that it's impossible to have, as you wrote once, a civil conversation about AEW's business. Because you get lumped in with people who are perceived as grifters, and people are perceived as just working the algorithm to get the most attention on all of their AEW, on all of their negative AEW content, which really, really does well. I mean, the times where we've like cut up clips of us talking about AEW business, especially when AEW business has been down, which has been the case for the last couple of years, it does more views, I've noticed, at least on my channel, than other run of the mill stuff does. So all of that algorithmic nonsense makes it really hard to have a civil conversation, because you have people in the comments who are accusing you of being, you know, bought WWE media when we're talking about stuff like this, because we will have real criticisms for AEW. So all that being said, let's set the table.
It's good for Brandon and I, because I think all companies dislike us. So we're good.
So TV ratings are down. They're down by 18%. If you just look at the demo, it's down by 19%. Attendance is down, whether it's Dynamite or Collision. Their market-to-market comparisons when it comes to live events are strongly down. There's real empirical stuff there. I won't go through it in audio, but there's clearly a downturn in their business at this time, at this exact moment, that in just last October, they made a TV deal that will probably make them viable, that will probably make them profitable, which is so counterintuitive to the direction of their company and sort of what we talked about earlier in terms of this business being transformed over the last few decades from being a live event business that was immediate feedback in terms of the ticket sales that you got, to being this sort of, you know, 3, 4, 5 year delay in terms of the TV deals that you get. And oh, by the way, it doesn't really necessarily matter what your TV ratings are on their face. What really matters is this image that I'll show in video, is where you rank among TV generally. And what I've got here is it your weekly average averaged out over time. I've got it broken down by year quarter. Suffice to say, Dynamite still ranks pretty strongly. Now, are we seeing some weakening? I would look at this and argue that we are seeing some weakening here, in that if you look at each year averaged by the quarter, we usually see Q1 start off fairly weak. Or what we see actually is, say, look in this late 2022 period, where their ranking starts off lower and then it sort of peaks up into Q3. And we sort of see a similar pattern here in each of those three prior years, from 2023 and backwards. And what we're seeing here is not that. We are seeing it bottom out here in Q4, but we do not see this upshoot from Q4 of last year into this year. Is it ranking poorly enough that David Zaslav and Kathleen Finch and Channing Dungey are freaking out in WBD headquarters? Probably not. But if you're looking at this fairly, aside from the times where they're praising each other in public, are they having some concerns about AEW's popularity? I think they should be having some concerns about AEW's popularity. And I will agree with Eric Bischoff about this, and that I don't really have any hope as far as it turning their popularity around, not in terms of whether or not they're going to survive as a business, but in terms of turning their popularity around to get back to the level of a year ago or 2 years ago. I don't really have any hope that that's going to happen, as long as what we all assume is going to happen is that as long as the head booker, Tony Khan, is still the head booker, this is clearly a product that needs to change who its head coach is. It doesn't necessarily need to change who the president of the company is and who's driving the business and who's making the TV deals. Tony Khan succeeded greatly by renewing their TV deals at a great increase of what it was, of what their incumbent deal was. And that's going to make this company financially viable in all likelihood, maybe by next year. But clearly the content has some problems here and it needs somebody else as the head coach. And everybody presumes that Tony Khan is just, well, we can't even discuss it. It's off the table to discuss that the owner of this company, who's also the head booker, is ever going to relinquish that power. And I think that's a conversation we should have more and say, well, why not? You've got the opportunity here to have a stronger legacy in terms of I think we're now in sort of a Vince McMahon situation in that, well, the owner, the guy with all the power is the head of creative, and there's just no discussing delegating that or stepping aside of that particular, that's just one of his jobs within AEW. There's just no conversation to be had about that, of putting somebody else in that role.
I was looking at this week's number. This was the Thanksgiving Eve number. And I know that there are plenty of factors that you can look at.
The West Coast feed. Oh my God.
You can throw at all of this, but I mean, Brandon, you just recently like crunched the numbers, like going like carrier by carrier of how much cable is down. And we can throw in the West Coast airing live last Wednesday night. The number I focused on looking at last year's Thanksgiving Eve show was the 18 to 34 number, which this year was down 55% from last week. And I don't care the worst prognostication you want to put on where cable has fallen or West Coast viewers not being able to tune in or the lack of promotion for it. Like, I put a lot of emphasis on the 18 to 34 number because I think that dictates a lot of a company's momentum and what is being focused upon. And yes, this is probably not indicative of a typical week's drop year over year in that demo, but it is, it summarizes or confirms, I think, a lot of people's thoughts towards the trend of the product. And to me, that was a very alarming number. And you're starting to have a lot of the same discussion about the on-screen product. That is it, the players that are on the field? Because I don't know how many rosters have had this level of talent and experience. Like, this is a loaded roster. Are they being utilized to the best of their ability? Which are arguments we had about WWE in 2019 and had with TNA in 2009. And often it is looked upon as a creative direction and a philosophy that engulfs the show that the viewer is getting. And this was a product that was very much in the wrestling zeitgeist and connected to that pulse in 2019. And I would say through to 2022. And today in 2024, it does not feel like it is on that same pulse. But what they have going for them is this television deal and the fact that Dynamite especially has held up in the rankings. And you can have these discussions to venture out and use a football analogy, which I correct me if I am wrong, but this year the Bills are 10-2 and they are in yes. first place. Next year, they could be in a much weaker division. And if they are in the same boat, they are 8-4, they could still be in first place, but still be a weaker team than they were the year before. These things can be true. Your competition could be less next year and your ranking will subside.
Yeah. Midway through last year's Bills season, I think Sean McDermott was not feeling safe. I remember having the discussion, well, if he doesn't win at least one playoff game, maybe he's out of a job. He's still a coach, though, because they did win at least one playoff game. I think the thing that people will raise is, but isn't Tony still the best one to be the head of creative for AEW? And is there anyone else that you could see being the head of creative for AEW? And the first person who comes to mind for me as an alternative would be Bryan Danielson. But there's other strong wrestling minds in that company too. I think Chris Hero is still an agent, producer, whatever their term is for producers in AEW. And again, I would look back to, nobody knew who Tony Khan was until 2019. And yet he turned out to be a very good booker for several years. And I think that time has come to an end.
That should be a lesson. That this incredible barrier to entry to book national television Should it be as high as we sometimes make it out to be? Because such a small, it's been for a generation, just a musical chairs of the same figures that have occupied these positions in national wrestling companies when it comes to booking slash writing.
Yes. So I think there are alternatives that are reasonable to think about, but I think it's off the table for wrestling conversation. Perhaps it's off the table internally in AEW because we all just assume that that's not a delegation option that Tony Khan is willing to consider. And I think if that's the case, which probably is, I think we should consider why. Then you're putting ego first before business and you're playing right into the stereotypes. And in fact, the criticisms that CM Punk raised in a different interview with Ariel Helwani this isn't a business. And I think what he meant by that is that business goals are not being prioritized like they should be ahead of other things like perhaps talent relationships, perhaps indulging in being the head booker of a wrestling company.
Do you feel that this is something that when an Eric Bischoff says like there is no hope of turning this around, let's give the benefit of the doubt that he is stating that in a way that it's not literally impossible to turn this around, but that a Tony Khan is not going to give up this role, that he is too tied to this role of being the creative visionary, that this is ultimately, I mean, this is going to be Tony Khan's company, much like it was Vince McMahon's company that took basically an act of God that no one foresaw that would remove him from power. Like there was
a scandal to remove him and to actually improve their business and inversely hurt AEW's business.
And in another period, probably would have survived a scandal. Like if this was a private company, none of this is getting reported on by the Wall Street Journal. This would have just been something that probably the public would have not known anything about. Like this was at its core. This was a story about money that drove the Wall Street Journal to report on. But that's getting away from things. The idea that we can have all these discussions about alternative creative ideas, but at the end of the day, is the owner of this company going to remove himself from that position? And what would put him into a position to make that move?
Who's going to be the Nancy Pelosi to his Joe Biden? Who's going to have the sit down and say, look, you know, you've been a great president of AEW. You've done things that nobody could have done. And you're going to be remembered as one of the great leaders in all of history. But the thing that will make you an even greater figure of history is to step aside at this crucial moment and let whomever, if it's the Kamala Harris role here, then run for election and then lose, actually. So
this might not work out so well. No pardons being handed down either. But I guess it is a discussion that, again, I always look at, like, if you want to be somebody that is going to defend AEW's position, you have ammunition to support that argument. I think that you, if you are Tony Khan, if you are someone that is loyal to Tony Khan, you can make a lot of arguments about how Dynamite still performs. But I think if you take an objective look at what is the trajectory of this company and do we want to take this product and roll the dice over the next 3 years that we also find ourselves in a position where cable is still declining and we are an asset to these cable networks with this product? Is this the team and is this the coach that we want to take for the next three seasons versus addressing things now where things are, they are not, this is not a recession, but we are certainly not, this is not a prosperity period either for AEW. Let's like, if this is WCW, this is, I would say spring of 99. This is not spring of 2000.
Yeah. And I, again, to be clear, cause I see that whenever you talk about AEW business too, the chat gets, it bubbles. I'm not talking about Tony not being the president of the company and not continuing to make media deals and continuing to lead the company as an executive.
No,
I'm talking specifically, narrowly about head of creative, that specifically and not anything else.
Like if we're going to focus on the creative, like the tone, like there is not enough acknowledgement of how nearly impossible it would be for a television deal of this magnitude. Like, following as much MMA, the amount of attention and coverage that PFL gets, if PFL could do a fraction of what AEW has done, I mean, it's remarkable to me that this is a company that does, like, it just exists because it has gotten great funding and it was able to get on ESPN, but this thing does not barely register on pay-per-view. It is like it is nowhere near, it could never draw to the level of an AEW on any recurring basis. And they have been able to garner like so much attention within the MMA media space. But an AEW, like, there are a lot of success stories that you can lean on that Tony Khan has spearheaded. And this television deal, it's how many attempts has there been for a non-WWE product to get on television, much less one that has paid this degree? Like, I think you do have to separate the creative direction of company with the results, and many are going to justify the results with what has preceded it, that this creative direction has caused this audience to tune in, that we have turned into real significant dollars that will turn this company profitable.
And I think TNA is a lesson there too, in terms of you can have enough problems, bad enough creative, or hiring people that your network tells you not to hire back, can lead to your downfall in distribution from not being on the Spike Network, which became Paramount, and being on Pop TV.
Wholly irrelevant.
Now you're on Access TV, which is a decent network, but it's in, I don't know, a third of the U.S. households in any case. And in terms of judging the content, at least in terms of critical success, and I understand, you know, being a head booker, being booker of the year is something that's important to Tony. And if you look at something like cagematch.net event ratings to see how the inmates are just critically receiving the major weekly programs. And now we've got a log jam here at about 6.8, which is where almost everybody is essentially tied now. We've got NXT actually in the lead. NXT, the most critically well-received TV show on cagematch.net right now. Just behind it is Dynamite. And then just behind Dynamite, with only a tenth of a point behind, is now SmackDown. And there even was in Q2, Raw was rated above Dynamite. It was the most well-received show in Q2 of this year. So, I mean, in terms of just thinking about, you know, if his goal is just to have the critical acclaim of producing a great wrestling show, he's not in the lead there.
Yeah, and it harkens back to our discussion.
Who won Booker of the Year in the Observer Awards last year?
Wasn't it Paul Levesque?
It was not Tony Khan. I believe it was Paul Levesque, yeah.
Like, it goes back to our discussion again that a lot of the critical acclaim for WWE, it is coming from large personalities at put in like very big star driven segments. And in AEW, like, there is the idea, do we lean into more of the non-wrestling, or is that a trap that you are essentially just presenting a lesser version of WWE, which is a trap we have also seen companies fall into. Like, there is that certain, like, AEW can put together a tremendous lineup each week on its television. But I think it is more intangibles that the audience is seeking out. And that does go to, like, the engagement people have in this Jon Moxley Death Riders storyline. That is the A storyline in the company. But there's been no indication of that being this galvanizing force that is bringing this company added attention, and that you're building to this big crescendo that the audience is on the ride for.
Yeah. I mean, you can kind of see it too, and I would say the age of the audience too, which the median age of the audience, of AEW's audience, has increased, gotten older, while over the same course of time, the age of WWE's audience has gotten younger, which always says to me, you know, these are the people who are the slipperiest viewers, the youngest viewers, who are the hardest to capture, who are the most addicted to TikTok, and are the hardest to get to watch your show, and they're to a lesser degree than before watching your show, and to a greater degree than before watching WWE's show.
And we can't have a discussion about AEW without this name coming up. Super Chat from Andrew McDonald. Do you think the CM Punk backstage video was the start of the big?
That was the beginning of everything. It's a million different things, right?
Yeah. I didn't think it was a great idea. And I think at the time I said, well, let's see what presentation is like in the fallout, I will maintain I still thought that was a very silly idea at the time. And but was that a killer? No. But I mean, you can lump it in. I didn't view that as a positive then, and I don't now in hindsight. But that was done. All right. Well, there you have it. The state of AEW, as always. Let's end off on this, because last week was the Thanksgiving Eve edition of Dynamite. They did 536,000 viewers and a 0.15 in the demo behind the NBA and Gutfeld in primetime on cable. And this became an interesting observation back in 2000.
Gutfeld now?
Gutfeld, yes.
Is that a wrestling show? When you have three wrestlers on your show, are you not a wrestling show?
At this point, once you're booking Aaron Idol, Aaron Stevens on your program with Bubba Ray Dudley, you are definitely up for wrestling show of the year or worst wrestling show.
Former NWA champion on your show. I mean, you know.
Yes. I won't say it. You had the best theory about booking Bubba Ray Dudley. But nonetheless, it was third in prime time. So back in 2019, this was the second month that Dynamite was on the air. And Thanksgiving Eve occurred, and suddenly we saw this dip. And that, to me, was one of my earliest examples of, is AEW dead? Was like 6 weeks in. Thanksgiving Eve, everyone's done. And then it was, hey, Thanksgiving Eve, pretty bad night to run for AEW's younger skewing audience. And then in 2020, and all these numbers Brandon did post on Twitter for everyone's easy accessibility. The next year, this was in the height of the pandemic, where they also saw a bit of a dip that week. But realistically, from 2021 on, this has not been the albatross that I think it's been made out to be. That yes, our first 2 years, you could certainly rely on Thanksgiving Eve affecting audiences. But I mean, for the last four, or I should say from 21 to 23, these were relatively consistent audiences tuning in. And then this year, a big hit that they took. This was, by the way, their lowest 18 to 49 audience in its normal time slot ever in the history of Dynamite. And I can't chalk that up to just being Thanksgiving Eve or the West Coast viewership.
If things were healthier, it would have done a low rating, but you can't explain it away with the West Coast feed. Let's say that's 5%.
These are factors, but not outright. Yeah.
You can't causes. Explain this away with cord cutting over time, which, I mean, year to year looks like it's about 5% based on looking at all the MVPD carriers and some estimates about them. This was down in the demo 44% from last year. There's no external factors that account for that difference. You have to look look inward eventually and say, oh, maybe it's just how the content feels overall in general, not just this episode, but just the way that people feel about AEW right now.
All right. And, that's going to, bring an end to things. We had quite the delay with numbers. Thanksgiving just threw a monkey wrench into all of the numbers. SmackDown did come in. They were up against both the NFL game on Amazon and a big Georgia Tech game on ABC. So SmackDown kind of took it on the chin on Friday.
You want some exclusive collision and rampage numbers that I'll okay. be
So this
publishing.
This was the 3 hour block on Saturday with Rampage airing against the first hour of Survivor Series.
Yes. Collision 144,000, Rampage 126,000. Those are total audiences for both. And I will do some math and get you the demo in a moment. It's 40,000 viewers in the demo divided by, that is a, can that be right? A 0.30 in the demo and a 0.03 in the demo.
Yeah.
And a 0.03 in the demo for both Collision and Rampage.
Yeah. That's, I think that the move to Saturday was not going to help. I think being on relatively, well, for Collision right before Survivor Series. Four till seven.
To seven. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a bit lower than I anticipated it being, but I did not think these were going to hold up too well. I think that time slot was terrible for it. I will say
it would have been worse going against Survivor Series. Maybe not that low.
I mean, Rampage, the fact it stayed in that demo going against Survivor Series, I guess that is a credit that they at least in 18 to 49, they maintained that audience for the, that was the Lucha themed edition of Rampage, which did you and I not just joke a few weeks ago about giving up Rampage to Rob Beharie and the Cubs fan for a Lucha night?
Maybe we
inadvertently booked that edition of Rampage. All right. Well, there you have it. Full reports over at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can get all the access to all of these breakdowns. Raw.
We'll have Collision and Rampage ratings up soon after I go off the air here.
And Brandon, you are back this Sunday after a week off. Is this this is a free edition of WrestleNomics?
This is a free edition of WrestleNomics Radio, free for everyone on YouTube. Sunday at 11, we will discuss stuff that I put in slides. And there'll be numbers involved. There will be year-over-year differences. I'm sure that will be analyzed and things of that nature.
And over at postwrestlingcafe.com, I decided to go down the rabbit hole after watching the Ted Turner series on Max and look at the relationship between Ted Turner and professional wrestling, going back to the days of ABC booking in Atlanta, and quite the underreported fact uncovered by the great David Bixenspan that the first wrestling to air on what was WTCG, Capital Wrestling out of Philadelphia, the first McMahon-Ted Turner collaboration. Vincent J. McMahon, my apologies.
I'm just making sure it wasn't Jess.
Yes, not Jess McMahon.
Do you know Jess is not his legal name, I think it's Roderick. Which I know is there are other Rodericks in the McMahon family, but I was doing some research, doing some ancestry research recently.
Yeah, that was Vince Jr.'s brother's name, the late Rod McMahon, who we almost got on television once. But that Ted Turner story is up, postwrestlingcafe.com, and Wei Ting and I will be back on Thursday with our edition of Talk, where we are going to uncover, the state of post wrestling. We'll go through metrics. We might do our yearly fiscal analysis of post wrestling, but wow, only for patrons. So maybe we'll.
I'm available for consulting services if you need.
We might need Brandon Thurston as our third party. But there you have it. That's all the latest. We will be back in this time slot next Wednesday. We will give a heads up. We are going to be off on Christmas Day, unfortunately, and New Year's Day as well. We might fit in a show that first week of January before the Netflix premiere and such, but to be determined, but we will not be live those two Wednesdays for sanity and family obligations. So
Dynamite's last exclusive cable broadcast will be on Christmas Day.
Correct. From the Hammerstein Ballroom, I think.
So that'll probably be a record low rating just because it's on Christmas, but yeah.
That's where they put Effie on.
There you go.
On that note, thanks to everyone. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for tuning in live, and we will speak with you next week.
Miles here is an electrician running wiring for this new home build.
Good morning.
Miles doesn't have time for funny business.
I guess.
Miles traded up to Serious Commercial Auto Insurance from GEICO for customized coverage that grows with his business, all for seriously low rates.
So where's the GEICO surprise cameo?
Come again?
You know, like some big famous football player or something. He's going to bust through that wall, isn't he?
No, this ad is serious business.
Guys, get over here. You got to see this.
No, there's nothing funny over here. Sorry.
Get more with GEICO Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.